Hello and welcome to the Champions for Social Good podcast, the podcast for people dedicated to social impact. I'm Jamie Serino, Director of Marketing with the Corporate and Foundation Solutions Division of Blackbaud. I'm here today with Dr. John Feather, Chief Executive Officer of Grantmakers in Aging, the National Society of Grantmaking Foundations and other organizations that work to improve the lives of older people. Dr. John Feather is also a recipient of the ASA Award, the highest honor of the American Society on Aging, for his work in policy, practice, and education. Welcome, John.
Well, thanks. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Can you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and your background and a little bit about Grantmakers in Aging?
Well, sure. As you mentioned, Grantmakers in Aging is an association, really the only national association in the world that focuses exclusively on aging issues and works with those who provide funding for organizations that work in these arenas. So most of our members are grant-making foundations, but it also includes corporate support groups and corporate funding groups, some individuals, and other kinds of public charities like the United Ways of the United States. So we have a variety of members, most of whom are regional or local funders. In terms of my own background, I've worked in the field of aging now for 35 years, primarily on the healthcare side, even though I'm an organizational sociologist by by training. I worked in the medical school for a long time in one of the first geriatrics programs in the country in Buffalo, and then it moved on to AARP, and then have been in this current position with Grantmakers in Aging now for 6 years.
Great. Okay, can you talk a little bit about how you work with your members to, you know, increase the effectiveness of their programs or share knowledge, education, that sort of thing?
Sure. Like most membership associations, we do educational work that includes for us a monthly webinar series as well as a variety of other kinds of educational programming. We have an annual meeting and additional meetings throughout the year for funders who are interested in specific topics. Our annual meeting is our big national get-together. And we facilitate networking in a variety of ways. We have a members-only portal that allows our members to ask each other questions and those kinds of things, as well as more informally just helping people get together around specific topics.
Okay, that's great. What are some of the main trends that you're seeing today, some of the themes that you're seeing in philanthropy focused on aging issues?
Well, I think one thing for everybody to understand is that aging remains a very difficult, it's a hard sell in philanthropy. I often say it's less than 2% of American philanthropy currently from the foundation point of view. There's actually been some recent research that looks at it as an issue across funding in general, all individual funding. Mm-hmm. And they only come up with 3% of American philanthropy goes to aging issues. And this is in a context where, 20 to 25% of the population will be over 65 in the next 10 years.
Right.
So it remains a difficult one, but we are actually moving forward in a variety of ways to look at aging as a lens to help funders think about their own programming. So if you're a funder that works on rural development, for example, the highest concentration of older people anywhere in the United States is in rural communities, mm-hmm. Mostly because they've had out-migration for many, many decades often. And the people that are remaining are often older folks who are often isolated. So what we're trying to do is increase the number of folks who include aging in their thought process and in their grant process by having them understand that aging issues are part of whatever they do, whether that's housing or health or, in this case, rural or arts or whatever it is that they do.
Right. So what comes to mind for me the first thing that comes to mind for me is healthcare. And so mm-hmm. I imagine that you get intertwined with a lot of healthcare issues, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. No, we do. We do lots of work on healthcare, and obviously that's an incredibly important issue around aging issues. You know, I think one of the difficulties in answering the question about what trends we see is that, you know, there's certainly major topic areas like elder abuse and elder justice, or family caregiving, or other things along the specific lines that have, you know, remained important issues. But we're in a context right now where it's just very difficult to predict on health or anything else where exactly all this is going, because for the first time in a long time, you know, we're actually challenging the basic assumptions around which all of this programming takes place. So for our members, that's a very complex thing. If you know, congregate meals, for example, is dropped from the federal budget, it's very likely that the place where people will go for support of that will be to their local foundation community.
So do you see some of these foundations preparing to step in where maybe there might be these deficits?
Well, that's the difficult thing. I think there's a lot of caution right now and a lot of seeking of information right now about whether or not this is the time to really start doing, you know, major investments in completely new areas, particularly for our local foundation members who are, you know, serving a particular community or geographic region. I think everybody is kind of doing a wait and see right now, because we just don't know what's going to be coming. And it may be that some of the traditional aging programs that are funded by the federal government or the state governments will decrease or disappear, but we don't know that at this point. So one of the things that we try to do is just simply provide as good an information as we can by providing, basically, we're doing a Washington Insiders series. So we have speakers come and talk on the phone to our members, just basically saying, this is what we're hearing. You know, it's not verified fact one way or the other. It's just what some people that spend a lot of time paying attention to these issues are hearing about the issues and how it might impact them at the local level.
Gotcha. Can you tell me a little bit about Grantmakers and Aging, the age-friendly initiatives that you have going on?
Sure. This is one of the real success programs of the aging movement around the world, in a way that I think has surprised a lot of people, including those who came up with the idea. It originally started with a group of international cities, so it wasn't age-friendly communities, but it was age-friendly cities initially, that came together about 10 years ago under the aegis of the World Health Organization and started talking about, you know, how do we make cities at that point and now communities good places for older people to live as they grow old. So a lot of those, and what they came up with is a document that sort of lists eight major areas of work, and then a kind of a process that people can go through to be part of this effort. I think, you know, truthfully, like most programs like that, it's a wonderful thing to start. Everybody was excited. And then you kind of expect it to kind of fade away. And it really hasn't. There are now something like 350 of these communities around the world in, I think, 40 countries. There are probably 100 and something that are part of the official process here in the United States. So this is something that's just exploded. And so what we're trying to do now is to catch up with that. We've been very involved in it from the beginning, pretty much, in terms of we had funding to create a system with five different regions in the country to help them create age-friendly communities in their regions. And we're continuing that work now with different communities in Massachusetts and probably expanding that to the rest of New England over the next couple of years.
Great. So can you tell us a little bit about, what makes one of these communities different? What are some of the features?
Well, the thing is that what the model says is that to really have a place where older people can thrive. It's basically many of the things that you would want for a for anyone to thrive. So safe neighborhoods, decent housing, access to health care, all of those kind of things. But it says that in order to make that happen, we have to actually pay attention to the specific needs of the population in general, but certainly in this case to older people. So the way different communities do it is based on what they find as the most pressing needs for their community. Mm-hmm. So it could be as simple as thinking about, you know, sidewalks or streetlights or, you know, any of those kind of real infrastructure stuff. But it also has to do with, you know, if you have the best healthcare system in the world and it's in a place that's inaccessible to anyone that doesn't have a car, it's basically pointless.
Right.
And so looking at those kind of issues, how do you integrate all the pieces together? How does transportation allow people access to healthcare in a way that that may not be possible otherwise? And that's really the notion, is that you start looking at how all these pieces fit together and help the community grow stronger. Over time, what happens is that people start to see those connections more clearly, and they start to ask, well, why does the bus route go right past the senior center and stop six blocks away?
Yeah.
Well, because no one ever talked to the people that run the bus system and asked that question. It's not typically that people are looking for ways to make older people's lives difficult. It's just that it's a failure for all of our systems to come together because they're so complicated.
Yeah, and so when one of these communities, if a person wants to create one, who is generally the person that approaches you or the people that run this program? Hey, I want to create one of these. How does that work?
Well, it happens any of a number of ways. It does require some local leadership, and that comes from a whole variety of places, sometimes from academic settings, sometimes from folks who are in charge of aging programs, sometimes from political leaders, sometimes from community activists. So it comes in a different place. The process sort of starts with the mayor and the city council doing a formal resolution saying, we want to do this. Mm-hmm. And that's where a community enters into, you know, the formal process. But unlike what sometimes communities think, it's like, you're not an age-friendly community now. You've just started the process of becoming an age-friendly community. And what basically the resolution says is that, you know, we commit ourselves to working on these issues over the next 5 to 10 years to try to make our community a better place. Because these are very long-range things. New York City has a 50-year plan to create an age-friendly community.
Wow.
And when that came out, people were like, well, you know, because and the notion is, because you don't do infrastructure development all at once. So you're not going to replace all the sidewalks in the city of New York in the next 10 years. But over 50 years, you will. And but if you don't build in, design standards and so forth that makes it more acceptable for older people to use, you know, it still won't happen. And that was Mayor Bloomberg's point, is that 50 years from now, we won't have an age-friendly community if we don't start now.
Right. And I imagine technology plays a big role. So when you said they have a 50-year plan, I would imagine that the driverless car is a part of that 50-year plan, which would be extremely helpful to lots of people. Any other examples of technology being factored into some of these communities?
Well, certainly that's an interesting one. There's a lot of interest in the driverless cars, autonomous vehicles, whatever. Yeah, we're calling them, which, you know, and it's certainly getting a lot of attention and a lot of lawsuits at this point. But it's yet to be clear whether or not that in of itself will be an essential piece. But one of the things we're working on, interestingly enough, is how do you take not only that kind of technology, but others enter rural areas. Mm-hmm. And everyone's a little skittish about this because, it's like, well, how would you make that work and so forth. But you're starting to see models kind of emerge where not so much the driverless cars yet, but things like Lyft and Uber and that kind of system where basically in a town that could never support, a taxi system, for example, mm-hmm. you have people that are, have a car, they're working part-time, they're doing this. In some communities, they're buying the vehicles and then using a Lyft or Uber type system to get the drivers involved. There's a whole variety of new kind of models that are coming out, particularly meeting places which are not urban. So that, the density of the population is not sufficient to carry that. Mm-hmm. But even in urban areas, there's a lot of interest and a lot of experimental work going on already with, to give an example, the Veterans Administration system is one of the biggest users of transportation vouchers in the country, which most people don't know. They pay for veterans at certain income levels, basically give them a taxi voucher to come up and back. Mm-hmm. Well, in some places this works well, in many places it doesn't. So now instead of it being going to your credit card when you use Lyft or Uber, we charge it to the VA. Mm-hmm. And so lots of different approaches and models at this point. We don't know exactly where all that's going, but transportation is a central issue everywhere, all the time.
Sure.
And I think one of the things that we forget is that if you're in one of these post-war cul-de-sac communities, if you lose the ability to drive, you're a prisoner of your neighborhood. And, and that it leads to depression and isolation and lots of other things if we don't have a way to get people in and out.
Yeah. Do you see any of your members, looking for other kind of new solutions? Are they directing their grant dollars towards, what are some new ways we can solve problems that older people face?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the interesting ones of our members is we have the Consumer Technology Association has a charitable foundation, which is entirely focused on the use of technology to improve the lives of older people. Mm-hmm. And so they're particularly engaged in all this, but many are. I think the caveat is while all of these exciting new things are developing, we're still, we're back to sort of wondering about, is the basic infrastructure going to hold underneath it because of all the political stuff that's going on at this point.
So another initiative that caught my eye was the Reframing Aging Initiative. And, it caught my eye because I just think that maybe it's a matter of, the fact that I'm getting older, and so I feel differently about aging, or I just think that people are living longer, and I think people are remaining vital, a little longer. And so to me, in my mind, aging has become reframed a little bit when I see, older people interact and watch how their lives unfold, and it just seems a little different than when I was younger. So that it just seems to sort of, in a way, naturally be reframing a little bit, but what are you guys doing to kind of push that along and create a reframed idea of aging?
Well, we're working with eight national aging organizations that include AARP, National Council on Aging, American Society on Aging, to really pull together around this issue of why is the issue of the way we understand aging so difficult to push past? Why is ageism so pervasive in our society? Mm-hmm. Why do we still always joke about, a wonderful example for me is how often, now that I'm 65, people, go into a store or something like, well, young man, what can we do for you today? Now, I know that the person doesn't mean that as an insult, but they're basically saying, You know, it's better to be a young person than an old person. I'm clear, you know, I've got white hair. I'm clearly not a young person. But, you know, but it's that's a really pervasive sense within our society. So what we ended up doing was commissioning a couple large studies from a group called the Frameworks Institute, which is won a MacArthur Prize for one of the innovative organizations in the world. And what they do is look not just at perceptions around a particular issue, but how do people put all those perceptions together into a frame, into a framework of understanding. And their first report, if you just Google the words gauging aging, G-A-U-G-I-N-G, so measuring aging, gauging aging, it will come up. Really fascinating. And particularly fascinating is the fact that they look at the way people like me who work in the field think about aging versus the way the American public does. And to give one of many interesting examples is American individualism, the notion that, you know, we work hard, we do good, we pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, has this, in some ways, devastating impact on the way we think about aging, which is that, you know, if you get to be an older person and, you know, you've got health problems or you don't have enough money, well, gosh, you didn't do the things you were supposed to have done. We told you to eat better. We told you to exercise. We told you to stop smoking. Of course, it doesn't take into account that, you know, a large part of this may be genetically based. You're not going to go back and pick better parents this time. So, you know, you've got to, but it really does feed into the sense that, well, you know, why should I worry about your problems because you didn't do the things you were supposed to do? And, you know, there's lots and lots of insights around this and so forth. We're getting ready for another major report, which really talks more about, so how do we talk about aging in a way that's going to help people not reinforce all the negative stuff, but is going to help them, help us talk to people about a more nuanced sense of how the aging process works and how they can help on it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, too, because, you know, like everything you're saying, I think, is true. And some of it's, like, rooted in culture. And so when you look at, you know, traditionally some of the Asian cultures, they seem to have a high respect for older people and you know, feel like they can draw wisdom from them. And I think certain professions have a pretty intense apprenticeship sort of path that, you know, they won't even consider you a master of something until you hit a certain age. And so age is actually more highly respected. And so how do you... you know, sort of disrupt maybe a cultural root there and change that? It seems a little bit harder to change. Is there anything in particular that this initiative does, or the people that you're working with, anything that they're focusing on that can sort of unhinge that a little bit?
Absolutely. That's the whole issue, is that the whole notion of a framework of understanding is that it's a complete system that encompasses everything we understand about a particular issue, in this case, aging. And aging is one of the really firmly held sets of beliefs, because we all experience it ourselves. We see it in our families and our loved ones. You know, you may feel strongly about climate change, for example, but it's not something that you probably experience day to day in your life. And so for most people, they may have an idea about it, a belief system and why it's important, but it's probably not as firmly held. So one of the things we are better understanding is this is going to be hard to change. The cultural issues are very important. And so, you know, we can't talk about a single mainframe American model that's going to fit everybody. That said, it's also true that In many cultures throughout the world that we've traditionally thought of as having a stronger sense of connection with older people, that model is fraying or collapsing. You know, China is a wonderful example. In 20 years, there'll be 300 million Chinese over the age of 65, and that's larger than the entire population of the United States.
Yeah.
And what's happened in the last 50 years is that most younger people have continually moved into the cities, leaving older people in the countryside. And so they may see them once or twice a year. And so that notion that the family group somehow, you know, is going to make all this work, the Chinese government is exploring every possible option, because it understands that, you know, its traditional model of addressing these issues is simply not going to work. And interestingly enough, if you look at the top 10 countries in the world which will have the fastest growth in older people, all of them are in the developing world. So we think of, you know, Malaysia or Kenya or places like that as young populations, and they are, but they are going to get older faster than the United States or any European country ever did.
Yeah, it's and just the fact that people are living longer, it's just it puts a lot of pressure there. It's a fascinating topic, because I think, you know, people are healthier longer. They're, I think, maybe working longer by choice, and then living longer, which, you know, has implications there.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and let me make one more important point. There's a lot of discussion about the age wave, as, you know, the silver tsunami is probably a very common term. And, you know, the thing is, that really does feed into this negative perception. So think about what a tsunami is. It's a natural disaster where everyone dies. I mean, I don't think that's really what we want to talk about when we talk about that this is a historic bonus of longevity that our society and every society in the world has been given. We have to do a better job at it. We have to do a better job with it. But it's not a bad thing that people don't die at 35 anymore. And you get this, like, oh my God, what are we going to do? There's all these old people. They're all helpless. They're all pathetic. You know, and that kind of reinforcing those stereotypes, even with people that are trying to talk about aging in a different way, is something that we're going to have to do a much better job at. And that's really the point of this reframing effort.
Yeah, I agree. And it's, so when you look at like a tsunami, and I think people are looking at it as it's going to be a burden. It's going to be a big economic kind of, obligation there. And, you know, I think politicians look at that and people try to figure that out. But, you know, I think that also people are contributing longer, you know, so if they're working longer, they're contributing longer. And I think that needs to be highlighted as well as part of the reframing.
So our friends in Atlanta and Kansas City have recently done some really fascinating economic work using the standard models that everybody uses to predict, you know, the regional economic growth of an area. And they asked a fairly simple question. If you were able to add 1,000 people to your community every year for the next 20, 30, 40 years, would you rather have working age people or people over 65? So, you know, if you ask any mayor, if you ask an economic development council, which would they say? You know, 100% of the time, because I've done this now enough, they will say working age people. And that's the wrong answer. It turns out if you use these standard economic models, people over 65 contribute at about 4 times that rate.
Wow.
And that's because they don't use public schools.
Yeah.
You could redo it. If you didn't have everybody going to work and coming home from work at the same time, you could redo your transportation system to make better use of it. You know, they bring wealth with them in terms of pensions and Social Security and all the rest that, you know, they're not competing with the workforce you have there. So, I mean, it really is true that part of our problem is we tend to think of older people as, you know, dependent. Right. And there certainly are some, but they're a small percentage of the total.
Right. So moving on to the engagement initiative, this also I think is worth delving into a little bit. So I understand the project resulted in more than $5.3 million granted from 22 foundations to address aging-related projects. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. This was a project to work with regional associations of foundations. So basically organizations that all work at, in a local region of the country, to have them work more effectively in terms of providing information to their members about aging issues. You know, and it created a lot of interest and a lot of new thoughts about aging funding. Mm-hmm. And I think now we are continuing to work with the regional associations to try to incorporate that and to expand that so that, you know, we have a lot of knowledge and interest in the field of aging, obviously. And for most local foundations, they do, you know, they do the ballet, they do the Little League, they do, you know, Girl Scouts, they do all across the board. And they probably have a small program on aging. So the person in charge of that program may or may not have any background in the field at all. Mm-hmm. So that's obviously a large part of what we do. But it can be something that we can share more effectively if we have folks who are working with these local groups and trying to engage them at the local level around issues that will include older people. So it's not setting up a new program on aging. It's really thinking about, of all the things you do and the aging piece you do, how can we help you get there better?
Mm-hmm. That's great. And another question that's maybe related a little bit to this. So, you know, you're able to track that you had $5.3 million. Do you have any, like, other measurement programs in place that, you know, can see more where those funds are going and what some of the outcomes may have been and, you know, what some of the impact may have been? Do you have any measurement programs like that in place?
We certainly are continuing to try. I think one of the difficulties in this is that, you know, just for example, the difficulty in deciding what's an aging program and what, you know, what most of the organizations that collect this kind of information do is it has to say something like aging, elderly, something in the title of the I mean, we can have arguments all day about whether, for example, you know, cancer research should be counted as aging because 80-85% of people with cancer are older.
Right.
Those are not typically included in any of this stuff. Yes, we do try to measure that. You know, unfortunately, I think the one that we pay the most attention to because of our particular work is this one about what's the change in the philanthropic field in terms of funding towards aging. And it has not been positive. It's been stable for a long time, for at least 20 years, even as the population of older people increases rapidly.
Mm. So where do you see the field going? Where do you see, like, 5 to 10 years out, philanthropy and programs that are devoted to aging?
Well, it's hard to say exactly, of course, but I think what we're going to see is more cross-cutting kinds of programs. And once again, rural aging is a good one because, you know, it's a major component of any rural community. But we need people who are already engaged in those communities to pay more attention to the aging issue specifically. Mm-hmm. I think that's where the growth is going to be, not in the wonderful organizations that are supporting aging programs primarily, of which there are a few but not many. I think in terms of the subject matter areas, those have a tendency to wax and wane depending on, you know, a whole variety of factors, including what a specific foundation is interested in. But, you know, many of them are going to be perennial. I think the big question mark now is that we're in a moment where we're really looking once again at some of the basic assumptions about what the role of government is in, you know, guaranteeing some basic things about the older people in the United States. Mm-hmm. That is now this huge question mark in the middle of everything else. Because we sort of have assumed that the basic structure of that was going to remain intact pretty much no matter what. Mm-hmm. And now there, you know, really serious questions about whether that's in fact the case or not.
Right. So what can we learn from other countries about this?
Well, we are, in fact, working internationally with a number of countries, and it's interesting how similar and different the issues are. In most countries, there's not an organized philanthropic sector of the size of the United States. There is none around the world. So that aspect is certainly very different. But the questions about how does a government non-governmental agencies work together to try to improve the community as a whole, not just children, not just older people, not just something in between, but around everyone, is something that we see everyone struggle with. So the notion that somehow in Finland or Ireland or wherever, they've got it all figured out. I mean, all you have to do is talk to the Finnish and Irish folks working on Asian, and they just burst out laughing.
Yeah,
you know, it's very much however, the issue really does revolve almost entirely around what it is that the government is willing to fund. That is always the first place where programmatic money is found.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's a good thing in some ways. The bad thing is that it makes sort of the experimentation that we're sometimes able to do here using sometimes government money, but often philanthropic money, more difficult, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it also makes the process of how the government serves its people, much more part of the issue. And I think the contrast between some of the Asian countries, China being the big example, but many others, and European countries and the U.S., is probably, you know, kind of the sort of three models. It certainly in the Asian countries, the government is also a very predominant player. But how involved they are in aging specifically, how much they leave that to the traditional family structure, which is evolving very quickly and, you know, may not be able to provide that anymore.
Right.
That's what they're struggling with. The European countries are struggling with how do we continue to provide all of these services in a coordinated way, in a way that's not, you know, cost destructive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here it's, you know, once again, we're really basically challenging some major assumptions about what is the relationship between our citizens, particularly our older citizens, and the government and its support.
Right, right. That's great. So do you have anything to add?
It's very important for everyone to think about, both in their own life and also in terms of the way that they think about the issues of aging, to think really carefully about how it is we understand, we as individuals understand the issues around aging. Do we think it's basically up to us as individuals, and if you don't make a successful go of it, then it's your fault?
Right.
How are we supporting one another? How are we thinking about what the role of philanthropy, government, individual activities, the family, are we paying any attention to these issues? And I think that's really a central thing. We have to engage in a conversation that's more productive than we've had in the past. Maybe one of the good things to come out of the current political environment is that we are having a lot of those discussions right now. You know, it's mainly a screaming match so far as we can tell. But, you know, at some point, people of goodwill on both sides are going to need to say, so this is how I think we should do this. And, you know, hopefully that will also lead us to, you know, better place for for our rapidly aging society, which includes all of us.
Mm. All right, that's great. John, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a great conversation.
My pleasure.
Now, for our listeners, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Champions for Social Good. To learn more about Grantmakers in Aging, you can visit giaging.org and also follow them on Twitter at giaging. And you can learn about all these great programs that they have in place, and you can read more about those. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss an episode. And keep up with the conversation between episodes by following us on Twitter at Jamie Serino, at MicroEdge LLC, and at BlackPod. Thank you for listening.